This is Patron Suit Patron Patron, and this is a bonus episode for March 2019. I'm Tom, lifelong Gundam fan and occasional beard haver.
And I'm Nina. I fell in love with the Ball mobile suit the moment I saw it.
Every week, we end up with more research ideas than we actually have time to research. And sometimes we'll even do the research before we realize that the episode is already 90 minutes long and 2 days behind schedule. So today we're going to cover a couple of those from recent episodes, the design influences for the majestic Ball mobile suit from the Solomon arc, and Dr. Flanagan's weird beard from Duel in Texas.
Is that even a beard?
Yes, we're going to cover that.
Okay.
It is absolutely a beard. According to the World Beard and Mustache Association.
Well, they do sound like the authority.
We are calling this episode Cut for Time, Beards and Balls Edition. We also have an extended version of the Song Dynasty poem read by Wen for MSB 1.30 and an interview with her afterwards. So despite a very clean-shaven first couple of episodes, we've actually seen a ton of facial hair in Gundam. Almost all of it on the Zeon side.
Right. The only person on the Fetty side we've seen with facial hair was General Revel.
I believe that is true. General Revel does have some very impressive facial hair.
Full beard, with mustache, white.
Well, and they do the mustache as kind of distinct from the full beard. It's like a styled mustache and a full beard.
Yeah. It's not like super long. It's clearly well-tended, but it's a pretty significant beard and mustache. Yeah.
Whereas on the Zeon side, we get a whole range of different facial hair types. We've got the giant walrus stash. We've got the chin curtain. We've got the pencil-thin mustache. We've got the rhomboral. There's a lot going on there. It's a distinction that is consistent enough that it feels like there's something going on there. So over the course of the time we've been covering the show, we've been doing a little bit of research about beards and facial hair and what significance they might have. In Japan, especially, there's a very close connection between facial hair, which is called hige, and military spirit, martial vigor, fighting-ness.
Tom had too much fightingness and attacked his computer.
During the medieval period, hige, facial hair, was absolutely necessary for a warrior to be taken seriously. The size of it, the bushiness of it, that's what showed that you were a manly man, ready to go out there and do violence and also loving to other men. Like the powerful warrior you were. Which is why if you look at art from that period, you get a lot of big bushy beards, you get a lot of hugely bushy eyebrows. The eyebrows are kind of a separate thing from the beard and mustache, but they're totally essential to expressing the character of somebody through art. This is even more the case with women. This is a side note, but during certain eras in Japanese history, women would shave their eyebrows.
And then draw them in with makeup, right?
Yeah. I think it was charcoal. I think they would use charcoal to draw them in. But only married women shaved their eyebrows. So the presence or absence of eyebrows said a lot about the woman you were depicting in art. And likewise for the men, big bushy eyebrows, warrior man. Small little manicured eyebrows, probably a weak sniveling aristocrat. If you couldn't grow your own facial hair, and there were plenty of warriors who couldn't, you had to get fake hige.
Is this why so many of the helmets have mustachios on them?
Yeah, because a big mustachio indicates a powerful warrior. It's very intimidating. It's like all the weird demon faces that they have.
I always wondered about that because we love at the Metropolitan Museum of Art here in New York, going to look at the arms and armor, and they have a selection of Japanese arms and armor, and several of the helms have very fanciful facial hair.
It's great. And no less a historical figure than Hideyoshi Toyotomi, who was briefly ruler of all Japan, more or less, complained of having to procure fake hige for himself.
I don't suppose you saw if they used like human hair for it or animal hair or...
I think horse hair.
I feel like horse hair would have the appropriately like coarse nature if you were going for like manly beard.
And it was, you know, more easily procured than a lot of other hairs. Mm-hmm. Hige then fell out of fashion when the country stabilized, when the Tokugawa shogunate was established and shifted to more of a civilian kind of government. Hige became viewed still as a sign of martial vigor, but now in a negative way, because if you were too strong and warlike, the implication was that you were planning to rebel and break the peace of the country. And so in order to fit in and avoid any sort of problems, samurai shaved. They shaved their hige off. Hige would not return to popularity until, weirdly, the Meiji era. And I say weirdly because in general, you can track the rise and fall of hige with militarism, but in the Meiji era, hige returned because of Western fetishism.
I was going to say, Japan might not have been at war for most of that time, but they were in a process of rapid westernization. And what one book I read called Occidentalism, which is an amazing term, and I can't believe I've never read it before.
Yeah, and that was a time when facial hair was becoming very popular in Europe and in the United States, and it became popular in Japan to adopt that Western style along with Western dress and other modes of Western behavior. Interestingly, the rise of facial hair in Europe at the time can also be traced to warfare, and we'll come back to that in a second. Also interestingly, there are records of soldiers in England during the Victorian period complaining about the expense of procuring fake facial hair for themselves.
I love it. I love it so much. It shouldn't just be expensive for women to look beautiful.
Yes, everyone except men who can grow their own facial hair should have to pay to be beautiful.
Tom says, looking as if he hasn't shaved in a week when it's really only been like 2 days.
This is my power, my gift, and my curse. All right, so hige in Japan would make a comeback in the militaristic Taisho era, leading into World War II. After the war, thanks to a combination of post-war pacifism and the sudden availability of cheap disposable razors, hige went out of fashion again and has never come back, for the most part. You can still totally be fired in Japan for having a mustache. There have been a number of lawsuits about this.
I feel like you only ever see them on like artsy people.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at photos of various Japanese professionals.
In my research for this, I was looking at an article about facial hair in modern Japan, and the article says, you know, hige is disfavored in the Japanese workplace, especially in the following industries. And then it just lists just about every industry you can imagine.
I wonder if it's considered an asset for someone who acts in period dramas to be able to grow
instead of needing
prosthetic facial hair.
Though I kind of wonder if some of the actors don't use prosthetics anyway, just because it looks better than whatever they can grow themselves.
I'm sure some of them do, yeah. For those of you not watching along with us, the reason I dispute whether Flanagan's facial hair is a beard or not is because what it is his sideburns grow down into his mustache. Like, it's a seamless growth from sideburn to mustache with no hair on his chin.
Mm-hmm.
Which I guess I would call sideburns and mustache, but not beard. However, Hige doesn't care. Hige don't care. Hige is all of it. So there's that.
I'm so glad that you brought up what it should properly be called, because I spent a lot of time researching that.
And what did the various highly legit sources you found on the internet have to say about the definition of this facial hair? Does it have a name?
It does. It has a couple of names.
Oh.
There's a family of beard styles that are all sort of like and sort of unlike this one. So I'm going to talk through that. When we first encountered this beard in the episode, we had our guest Sean on with us, and he said it reminded him of a Civil War general, which he was absolutely right about. In the US, the most famous wearer of this style of beard is Ambrose Burnside, the Civil War general. He wasn't by any means the only one. If you look at pictures of Civil War soldiers and generals, this is a very common beard style.
But isn't he the reason we call them sideburns?
Yes, he is. Sideburns is a later corruption of Burnsides.
Burnsides.
Yep. Yeah, prior to him, they would have been called side whiskers or sideboards.
whiskers.
However, Burnsides are not quite right. They're a little too thick on the cheeks, a little thicker and longer on the cheeks than they are over the mustache, whereas Flanagan's is pretty consistent all the way around. It's good for Ambrose Burnside that he had such memorable facial hair because the other things that he is remembered for are not quite so flattering. He was a commanding general at the Battle of Antietam, where his toxic combination of incompetence and hubris turned it from an extremely winnable battle into the bloodiest single day in American history. He was also the commanding general at Fredericksburg, one of the worst Union defeats, where he turned a easily winnable battle with a massive numerical advantage into a bloody meat grinder. A report on the Battle of Fredericksburg inspired President Lincoln to say, "If there is a worse place than hell, I am in it."
But we decided to keep his fashion sense. At least the facial hair part.
Yeah, man, that's weird.
Yeah, well, so we talk a lot about World War II. Nobody really wears Hitler's style of mustache anymore. He nope. ruined it.
Yep.
You know, every once in a while, somebody famous tries to do it. I feel like it's pretty universally disliked.
Yep.
Too many bad associations.
Yep.
But somehow, this guy...
He was definitely a lower level of horrible.
Well, right, but...
Merely incompetent.
However... It is interesting that aspect got preserved.
Well, part of it, I think, is that this was actually a very popular beard style, even outside of General Burnside himself. And the reason for that is a little unclear. So this is around the 1850s, 1860s, and this is a period when beards are taking off in a big way. And for a long time, especially in Europe, beards had been... totally inappropriate, totally unacceptable for the upper classes. But from about 1800 through to 1850, they had a huge resurgence. And the reason for that is intimately connected to warfare, just like in Japan. During the early Victorian period, the fashion was very much clean-shaven, but with increasingly long sideburns. However, this was also a period when European armies were adopting the light cavalry units called hussars that were first pioneered by the Polish and Hungarian armies in Eastern Europe. Hussars were dashing and heroic. And this was a period when European armies were not just borrowing each other's tactical ideas, they were taking the whole cloth. So if you had a hussar unit, you would dress them like hussars. You would have them behave like hussars. You would have them grow their facial hair like hussars. It was a style. And because the hussars were so dashing and heroic and flamboyant, they had chests full of gold braid, they had capes that they wore, they had big bearskin hats, and they had giant mustaches. The mustache was intrinsically a part of being a hussar. And even in the British Army, which forbid facial hair for any soldier, the hussars were allowed and required to grow it. Which is where we get some of those complaints from soldiers about the expenses of procuring fake mustaches. Now, this started around the early 1800s, but due to a series of wars in Europe and the heroic reputation of the hussars, and increasingly of other soldiers too, especially because of the Crimean War, where soldiers from around Western Europe found themselves fighting in Crimea, where it's cold and where they weren't able to get any supplies of razors or shaving soap, were finally allowed to grow beards, and they did. And so when they returned home after the very celebrated war, all these dashing war heroes came back with big old beards.
And suddenly it became very fetching to have a beard.
Indeed. And this is how we get to the proper name for this family of beard style, because this is called the Imperial Beard.
Which empire?
Austro-Hungarian.
Aha.
This is the favored style of Franz Josef, who was the Emperor of Austria during World War I, and is arguably one of the largest cogs in the vast machine of European dynastic diplomacy that caused World War I. I should note, however, that the reason I say that Flanagan's beard is definitely a beard is because there is an imperial mustache, but it's a quite different affair. The imperial mustache is named for a different emperor and is two short, bushy mustaches and a small patch of beard on the chin, named for Napoleon III.
Oh.
Another largely incompetent emperor who played a major role in setting up the circumstances that made World War I inevitable. But while we can say these beards are called imperial beards and they were made popular by Burnside and by Franz Josef, that doesn't actually answer why those guys had that style in the first place. Why the big beard with the mustache and the shaved chin? Well, there isn't a good explanation, but I have a theory. This was the era when military style was everything for European aristocrats. Of course, it was also the era when they just gave themselves and each other commissions in their armies in prestigious units. Franz Josef, for instance, was made a colonel when he was 13 years old. And he would continue to wear military style for the rest of his life. So I mentioned before that this was a period when people were growing their sideburns longer and longer, and when soldiers were growing their mustaches bigger and bigger. I think it was a natural evolution of those two styles.
They just grew together.
Exactly. It was very military to have a big old mustache and to have big sideburns. And it was extremely military if you could grow them together. However, the classic Franz Josef imperial beard, like the Burnside beard, is a bit thicker in the cheeks. And Franz Josef in particular has a very distinctly pointed, styled mustache connected to big, thick mutton chop sideburns. The informal name for this is the friendly mutton chops, because they're two mutton chops that are connected in the middle.
Aww.
They're buddies.
They're friends.
Whereas Flanagan's beard-mustache combo is more of a straight line.
Yeah, it's all uniform length. There's no distinction between the part of it that's growing on his upper lip, or the part that's growing on his cheeks, or the part that's growing on his sideburn area.
Yes.
It's all the same.
There's a name for that specific one.
Of course there is.
It's called the a la Suvorov.
And who is Suvorov, pray tell?
Suvorov is one of the finest generals in Russian and indeed world history. He fought something like 63 battles and was never defeated.
I have never heard of him.
That is unfortunate. He was active in basically all of Russia's wars during the 1700s, kicking around the Ottoman Empire and Poland, and was recalled from political exile in order to lead the coalition forces against the French during the Wars of the French Revolution before Napoleon took over. After the French Revolution, mm-hmm. the French Republic went on a let's spread republicanism to all of Europe. And so they went on a series of wars.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that from my brief brush with European history.
It's how Napoleon initially distinguished himself as a commander.
Okay. Gotcha.
Before he took over the country.
Makes sense.
Now, Suvorov and Napoleon seem to have considered each other to be the finest generals of their age. Basically, everybody considered Suvorov to be the finest general of his age, except the Tsar.
Ouch.
He had been very, very close with Catherine the Great.
Mm.
When she died, her son hated him.
Womp, womp.
Do you know why he hated him?
Did she leave him some titles, or...?
It's so much pettier than that.
Was she just, like, nicer to him than she was to her son?
Even pettier. Paul really liked Prussian-style military uniforms, and Suvorov thought they were dumb as
So he got rid of them in Russia?
Yeah, Suvorov got rid of the uniforms. When Paul became Tsar, Paul ordered them reinstated. Suvorov refused and was exiled.
I mean, I get it, but also maybe don't refuse your czar?
I think Suvorov came at it from the position of, these uniforms will get my men killed. He was eventually recalled because during the formation of the coalition to fight against the French Republicans, all of the other nations insisted they had to have Suvorov. He was that good.
Love it. That's amazing.
Unfortunately, he was campaigning in Europe while Napoleon was campaigning in North Africa, so the two never got to meet and actually decide which of them was the better general after all. And Suvorov died before the Napoleonic Wars. Now, the a la Suvorov is a little bit weird. It is a French name for a beard styled after a Russian general who, based on all of the portraits that I have reviewed, never had a beard. So I don't know what's up there.
At some point, he must have.
Possibly. If I had to speculate wildly, and I'm going to speculate wildly even though I don't have to, I would guess that this has something to do with the uniforms that Suvorov implemented for his army. Either it was a beard style that he permitted, or perhaps there was a strap worn to hold the hat on that went down the chin like the beard does. And the reason I think it has something to do with the uniforms he implemented, which A, were a very important part of his career, and B, I found some old uniform manuals that talk about officers of a certain rank being required to wear their boots a la Suvorov, which suggests that a la Suvorov may refer to
a style of uniform
that he introduced.
I'm also picturing, because you mentioned some of the hats occasionally had a strap that went around the chin.
Mm-hmm.
That strap might not fit very well if you had chin hair, but you could still grow mustache and sideburns, and those wouldn't be in the way.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But you had to leave your actual chin bare,
right?
Because otherwise you couldn't wear the strap for your hat.
Well, and you couldn't have the full mutton chops because the strap probably goes below where the beard is.
Yeah.
We might have solved the puzzle.
That's it. We did it.
Alert the beard authorities.
One of history's greatest mysteries solved.
All of this fascinating stuff about beard history doesn't actually explain why Flanagan, of all characters, has this beard. Now, it could just be a Texas thing. We first meet him in the Texas episode. It kind of has an Old West kind of feel to it. The famous Texas Ranger Bill McDonald did wear a beard of that style. So that's possible. Here's another possibility. Werner von Siemens, scientist, inventor, former soldier, founding father of the field of electrical engineering in Germany, had a beard like that. I assume that he picked it up during his time as a Prussian army officer. And I think there might actually be a connection to Flanagan because von Siemens is kind of a weird dude for an industrialist of that era. He did found the massive Siemens company, which is still around today, but he was not a capitalist. He really thought that industrialization would be good for social democracy and would enable essentially solo artisans to make a living on their own without needing to be employed by people.
It's not totally wrong. It's not totally right either, but...
He was also one of those scientists who approached his work with a profoundly spiritual bent. Speaking about his work, he stated, "The deeper we penetrate into the harmonious action of natural forces regulated by eternal, unalterable laws, and yet so thickly veiled from our complete comprehension, the more we feel, on the contrary, moved to humble modesty. The smaller appears to us the extent of our own knowledge, the more active is our endeavor to draw more from the inexhaustible fountain of knowledge and understanding, and the higher rises our admiration of the endless wisdom which ordains and penetrates the whole creation." So it's not hard to imagine that Flanagan, a scientist studying new types for the Zeon military, might have been partly inspired by this former Prussian army officer who went on to become a spiritually minded electrical engineer with a utopian outlook on how his work could affect society. We love the ball. A big part of that is how unique it is. It's somewhere between a mobile armor and a mobile suit. It feels more utilitarian and slapdash than anything else that we've seen so far. It looks like a civilian machine built for cargo handling or construction in space. It's clumsy, it's poorly armored. Balls on the battlefield are like bulldozers among tanks. Although, of course, armored bulldozers for military use are absolutely a thing and have been since World War II, when the British took a conventional bulldozer and put some armor on it. That, of course, followed an even older tradition, starting before, but only taking off during World War I, of taking a civilian car chassis and adding armor and guns. This all started out very ad hoc. Some of the very first armored cars were cars that were allotted for the use of officers attached to Britain's Air Corps in France, but someone realized that the cars could be used to retrieve downed pilots, and it wasn't long after that that they realized it would be easier to do that if they put armor on them. The armor they originally used, they requisitioned from a Navy yard. It was meant to be boilerplate.
Huh.
Yeah.
I mean, it's strong. For reference, boilerplate meaning from the outside of boilers.
Yep.
That boil water for heat or energy.
Specifically for Navy ships in this case. And armored cars were preceded by what were called armed cars, the first of which was the 1898 Motor Scout. And I don't want to malign the Motor Scout because it really was an incredible feat of engineering for its time. And the guy who designed it is also the person who coined the words petrol and motor car. So, like, he made his mark on the world. But for all of that, the Motor Scout looks like a dieselpunk fever dream. Imagine a bicycle and another bicycle welded together with an engine in the middle. Powered by pedals or a small gas motor with a whole 1.5 horsepower.
Okay.
And most importantly, a Maxim Mark IV machine gun.
Which would be between the two bicycles?
Yes.
Okay. Interesting.
There are two different versions of the in-universe explanation for the ball, but as far as I know, neither one of them was ever confirmed in the anime, because, unfortunately, to date, no series has ever had the courage to do what needs to be done and tell us the story of the war from the perspective of a ball squadron. Make it happen, Sunrise. The first version of the ball's origin has it that the ball was developed around the same time as the gun tank, during the early stages of the V project that eventually produced the Gundam, gun cannon, gun tank, and the gyms. It was discarded at the time, but then revived during the war because gym production was desperately behind schedule, and the Federation needed something. Anything. In this version, the ball was purpose-built for space combat, and its, to be generous, lack of suitability for that purpose was ignored because the blueprints were ready and the need was desperate. As Beepluck, one of the fans in our Discord chat, pointed out, the off-center position of that giant cannon on the top of the ball means that every shot is going to send it careening off into space. To counteract that recoil, it needs to use its thrusters simultaneously with every shot, and that means extremely inefficient operation and a drastically reduced operational period. You would think that if the ball had been purpose-built for battle, if it were a battle ball, it would have its cannon near its center of mass to prevent that wild spiraling problem. That's why I think the second explanation is the more reasonable one. In this version, the ball started life as a civilian space vehicle, meant for zero-G construction or cargo management or whatever. And then the Federation did what armies in World War I did, and they took those civilian vehicles, gave them some ad hoc armor upgrades, and slapped a gun on wherever it would fit. Was any of this optimal? Of course not. But neither were those early armored cars. But an inefficient ball is better than no ball at all. The visual inspiration for the ball is also more consistent with the civilian vehicle version of its origins. Now, often when I'm trying to puzzle out what inspired the look of a mobile suit, it can be a tricky process of close analysis, guesswork, and lots of time on Google Images. And then sometimes you get ones like the ball. It's the space pod from 2001 A Space Odyssey. They just took the exact design and put a gun on it. Admittedly, the shape of the pod is a little less spherical than the ball, but not by much, and the arms are practically identical. Plus, they both have the same central window. The pod does have some detailing on the sides that kind of look like maneuvering thrusters, and the ball is totally different because it has those on the underside.
Totally different!
The original ball design did have arms that ended in only a single manipulator per each arm, while the pod has a distinctive two manipulators per arm design. But the later redesign of the ball that's used for the Master Grade Gunpla kit has the exact identical pod arms. It's a dead giveaway. The name for the ball seems straightforward enough. It looks like a ball. Though I think there might actually be some more to it, especially the decision to use the English word ball instead of a Japanese equivalent. During World War II, the U.S. developed spherical plexiglass gun turrets that were mounted to the undersides of bombers and used for defense against attacking fighters. This belly turret, made by a company called Sperry, was called a ball turret because of its shape. These were just barely big enough for the smallest of soldiers to squeeze into. You got in through a tiny hatch, you put your feet up on one wall, curled yourself into the fetal position, and you put your head and shoulders against the other wall. You shared this space with a pair of 50 caliber machine guns. Your left foot controlled your sights, and your right foot worked your intercom. There was an electrical system for maneuvering the turret around, but if that failed, someone outside had to use a hand crank.
Wow.
And once inside, you rotated with the turret, upside down or whichever other kind of way you needed to be. It was an exposed, isolated, cramped, and terrifying way to experience the war. Besides Gundam, the ball turrets inspired perhaps my favorite poem to come out of World War II, Randall Jarrell's Death of a Ball Turret Gunner. Jarrell was not himself a turret gunner, but he served during the war as an Army Air Corps control tower operator working with bomber crews. I will warn you, though, as you have probably guessed from the title, this is not a happy poem. From my mother's sleep I fell into the state, and I hunched in its belly till my wet fur froze. 6 miles from Earth, loosed from its dreams of life, I woke to Black Flak and the Nightmare Fighters. When I died, they washed me out of the turret with a hose.
This is the extended version of the poem that was read by special guest Wen, as well as a brief interview we did with her about the poem afterwards.
Good to go. 赤壁赋，壬戌之秋，七月既望，苏子与客泛舟游于赤壁之下，清风徐来，水波不兴，举酒煮客，诵明月之诗，歌窈窕之章。少焉，月出于东山之上，徘徊于斗牛之间，白鹭横江，水光接天，纵一苇之所如，凌万顷之茫然。浩浩乎，如凭虚御风而不知其所止；飘飘乎，如遗世独立，羽化而登仙。于是饮酒乐甚，扣舷而歌之。歌曰：桂棹兮兰桨，几空明兮溯流光，渺渺兮予怀，望美人兮天一方。客有吹洞箫者，以歌而和之，其声呜呜然，如怨如慕，如泣如诉，余音袅袅，不绝如缕。舞幽壑之潜蛟，泣孤舟之嫠妇。苏子悄然正襟危坐，而问客曰：何谓其然也？客曰：月明星稀，乌鹊南飞，此非曹孟德之诗乎？西望夏口，东望武昌，山川相辽，郁乎苍苍，此非孟德之困于周郎者乎？方其破荆州，下江陵，顺流而东也，逐卢千里，旌旗蔽空，诗酒临江，横槊赋诗，故一世之雄也，而今安在哉？况吾与子渔樵于江渚之上，侣鱼虾而友麋鹿，驾一叶之扁舟，举匏樽以相属，寄蜉蝣于天地，渺沧海之一粟，哀无声之须臾，羡长江之无穷，携飞仙以遨游，抱明月而长终，志不可乎骤得，托遗响于悲风。苏子曰：客亦知夫水与月乎？逝者如斯，而未尝往也；盈虚者如彼，而足莫消长也。盖将自其变者而观之，则天地增不能以一瞬；自其不变者而观之，则物与我皆无尽也，而又何羡乎？且夫天地之间，物各有主，苟非吾之所有，虽一毫而莫取，惟江上之清风与山间之明月，耳得之而为声，目遇之而成色，取之无尽，用之不竭，是造物者之无尽藏也，而吾与子之所共事。客喜而笑，洗盏更酌，摇盒既尽，杯盘狼藉，相与枕藉乎舟中，不知东方之既白。
Reciting that poem for us is our dear friend.
Hello, dear audience. My name is Wen. I am Tom, Nina's friend. We met each other in actually karate club. I'm actually doing my work in education. I had came to the U.S. from Beijing. That's where I was born and raised. And that actually one of my favorite points. And it was an honor for able to doing this.
Wen mentioned to us that this poem that Tom picked out is actually one that a lot of high school students have to memorize or recite in school.
Right. Exactly. So that's exact ode. It's something that I recited or memorized as part of my homework during my high school year, because that one was very meaningful and tells a lot about like the things that you need to know about life. And he shares something he interpreted about this world and through his own perspective. As agreed, poet, politician, and a great human being in general.
Why is he one of your favorite poets? What is it about him that is special to you?
A few reasons, some personal reasons, some about himself. So I mentioned to Nina a little bit earlier that his poem about his younger brother, his missing his younger brother, if I say it in Chinese, it would be like 明月几时有. That one was the first poem that I ever recited and memorized. My aunt taught me that before all the other easier ones. So I feel like there's some personal, like, first time memorizing and learn about it and really love that poem. Another reason was because himself. So I mentioned earlier to Nina and Tom that this person is pretty well-rounded person, that he, for his time, he had had, first of all, have a lot of thoughts that actually beyond his generation. He has some views about, you know, how to interpret about life, how to seeing things from specific perspective, like the one that we actually mentioned to in this one. This is one of the reasons. Another reason is he actually is a, I would say, pretty successful politician. He actually had his career and had some influence during his time. And not a lot of people were able to achieve it. I told Tom and Nina, like, poet have, like, inspiration from different places, some from if they're harsh life and they really hate something and they will complain a lot. And that makes a lot of the good poems. And one possibility will be, like, someone like Liu Yong was very famous, be around, like, surrounded by prostitute, and in that time a lot of prostitute are pretty, like, they know a lot of things because they deal with a lot of people, and some of them are quite talented on poems and a lot of things as well, an instrument, for example, and also someone who actually do have a feeling of life, and he is so sure this poet is actually one of them. And another reason is he is pretty, I would say, loyal to his wife, and he has actually two very famous poems is actually about thinking about his wife, and not saying he just only have one wife, especially during his time, but not a lot of people were able to do that when they really love with his wife, and after the wife passed away, they kind of remembered them and try to write even poems to actually thanks and thinking about the time, the treasure they spent together. So I feel like for all of these reasons, and of course a lot of other reasons, being he's being very talented, really good at calligraphy as well, really good at poems, like, and also shi and ci in Chinese are pretty different. Shi is like poem, and ci will be like there is a sound, but the tones are gone, but the lyric stays, quote unquote lyric, and you generalize it as a poem. So he's also very good at lyrics. For his time, Song Dynasty was actually like the time when this lyric would become peak on that time. And the thing we actually did today is, I think you call it ode, which is longer than most of the poems. So he's good on all of them, and writing articles and writing things to the emperor, that kind of stuff. Oh, and actually one thing really fun about him, his, I think, Su Shi Hao Dong Po. So he had a hao, and there is a famous Chinese dish called Dong Po Rou. People, like, have this myth that he invented it. Actually, it's not, but, like, he actually had this dish, which is really, really tasty, really famous. Pork meat with mushrooms and something else.
That's funny.
His whole family are very famous. His younger brother, his father, and even his younger sister. And they are teasing each other a lot as well by using poems. So
classy.
Very.
I hope you all enjoyed this bonus episode of Mobile Patron, Patron Suit, Patron Patron.
Patron, 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 patron.
Thank you all for your continuing support. We look forward to making many more of these in the future.
That was a weird noise. It just came out of my throat. no.
I'm not going to include that.
No.
So the things banned by the Sumo Association include beards, tattoos, and of course, women.
Womp womp. It is truly the haiku of horrifying war poetry.